DuPont knew that the respirators should be used.
Where would we find this in the record?
I believe it's in the statement of facts on the, it's certainly in our brief here before you, and certainly I believe in the statement of facts in the response to the motion for summary judgment.
By that you mean the place it could be found in the record is contained in your statement of facts?
Yes,
it's not just a statement of fact in your brief.
I believe that it was certainly before the trial court that DuPont was an expert. I'm saying DuPont generically. It's the defendant's word.
No, we understand that.
You're saying that if we search, we're going to find it in the appendix.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm saying that.
All right, we'll undertake the search.
Very good, Your Honor. And again, Your Honors, all aspects in this case fall within the parameters of 343. DuPont had a job to be done, a job that they demanded be used, that asbestos be used. DuPont hired these various trades who didn't know anything about exposure to asbestos and its hazards. DuPont put them all together at the same job site and did nothing.
Is it your view that Mr. Willihan's employer, when he was working for Honeywell or at the Honeywell site, that employer, that independent contractor, was not aware of the risks of asbestos?
According to the evidence, that is what it was, Your Honor. And Mr. Willihan, by the way, it was stated earlier, he carried asbestos onto the job site. He was a pipe fitter. He wasn't a pipe coverer. And if he carried asbestos onto the job site, it was in his pocket when he brought gaskets in there that are encapsulated. He was a pipe fitter. He followed the insulators, and he was exposed not by his use of gaskets, but by the insulators who were there using the asbestos products. The bottom line in this case is that the defendants argue that 343 requires control. They've had argument based upon cases involving Chapter 15 of the Restatement Second of Torts.
Who was the Maryland Court of Appeals construing 343?
Yes, Your Honor, Wager.
And the Maryland Court of Appeals concluded that you need to be controlled, didn't they?
I believe, Your Honor, we discussed that Wager case the last time I was here. Basically, what happened in Wager was, before Wager, Maryland law was Delaware law. Accepted 343. In an asbestos setting, Wager was exposed at the Baltimore Gas and Electric Company generating plants. In that case, the Maryland Court of Special Appeals accepted a case called Wells versus Western Electric. It's a Fed sub case. It was filed by a trial judge in the Federal District Court sitting in Baltimore. Basically, what that case did was the court held that in order for a premises owner to be responsible under, to have a duty, that he would have to have the ability to control the activity. And that meant this, that if in fact a premises owner does not have the ability to control what happens in the premises, he has no duty because he has no ability to correct the situation. It did not have anything to do with whether a premises owner has a right to control the manner and method of the contractors, only whether he has control of that portion of the property where this activity is taking place, and he can say, no, don't do that. In other words, if he doesn't have the ability to say, no, don't do that, then he can't violate a duty. That's what we talked about in in the Pura case, I may say, Your Honor, specifically a question, I'm told that DuPont's knowledge is only in the summary judgment briefs, which were before the trial court, and not in the appellate briefs that are before you.
The Chief Justice's question and my question is, are we going to find this in the record in the appendix, or are we going to find it in the form of an argument?
We're going to find it in the summary judgment motion statement of facts. Well, it was before the trial court, Your Honor.
I don't know if this is at all helpful, but on page 14 of the trial judge's opinion, he says, quote, defendant DuPont concedes that the record contains evidence from which a jury could find that DuPont had knowledge of the dangers of asbestos exposure. That's a finding of the trial judge from somewhere. And he frames it in the form of a concession by DuPont, at least before him, that they knew of the risk.
And I could only assume, Your Honor, it's because the motion for summary judgment did contain statements as to DuPont's knowledge, and they were not refuted in the response by DuPont, and so it was conceded.
So DuPont was relying on what they perceived to be a distinction between knowledge and control. For purposes of summary judgment, they conceded knowledge, but they wanted the case to be decided based on lack of control.
On lack of control, manner and method of the operations of the independent contractors, which is not part of 343.
So going back to the Maryland case, and I'm not bringing this up because your position didn't prevail in Maryland. I'm just trying to understand how the Maryland court decided it.
It decided based upon the Stead subcase. Okay.
So, but your position is they read control into the restatement when it wasn't there.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. And also my position is that the Maryland authority upon which the federal district court judge held about control was not what the Wager court ultimately held, but it was control over the manner and method of the operations of the independent contractors. Control is, and as we talked about in the Pura case last time, control means this, that if, in order to have a duty, any premises owner must have the ability to control the premises, not the operations of the occupants or the invitees, but in order to have a duty, you must have the ability to do something or refrain from doing something that would lead to a violation of the duty.
Now, how do you respond to Mr. Phillips' argument that to rule in your favor, we're going to have to overrule three decades of Delaware's common law?
Well, you're not. I think my argument here is very simple, Your Honor, that this court from 1971, which is the Redundo case, has accepted 343. In that case, it even involved an independent contractor who was called in after the homeowner had partially deconstructed the roof. He was called in without, and he, a timber fell on him because of a defect or a latent defect in the roof. There was no question in that case about control of the contractor's manner and method. Only the decision was based upon the fact that the defective latent condition in the roof was not known by the homeowner. As such, he was not responsible for warning of something he didn't know about. But clearly, we have an independent contractor in that case, and there's no talk about control of the contractor. All of the cases cited by DuPont and the other defendants are Chapter 15 cases.
But in Pura, which I realized was the commercial equivalent of 343, this court held that there was a triable issue of fact on control. So at least with regard to 344, control seemed to be important.
No, this court held there was a triable issue of fact on duty.
But it related to control.
Yes, but it didn't control. it didn't amount to the fact that they, sure, it was a hazing case out of the University of Delaware, and a student was seriously injured in a hazing incident. And the question was whether the University of Delaware had a duty to this pledge to protect him. And the issue before the court was whether the university had control over hazing. Not the matter or method of the hazing, but whether, in fact, put it this way, if in fact they had no right to control hazing, then they couldn't violate a duty that they didn't have. This court held there that because the university had instituted a policy on hazing, that the university in that instance had attempted to discipline the fraternity, that it evidenced its belief that it had the right to control hazing. If it had a right to control, and believed it had a right to control, it was a jury question as to whether they had a duty. But it was not, like the defendants were arguing, that University of Delaware had a right to control the manner and method of the hazing. It wasn't, well, you really shouldn't pour cleaning solution on the pledge, and when you beat them, you should use a smaller stick. That's not what we're talking, that's what the defendants are talking about. But the issue here is that if you don't have the authority to control something, then you can't breach the duty to control it. And that was the issue in Furyk, not that the defendants were arguing here that in order to be responsible in a 343 situation, the defendants would have to say, you got to do it this way, you got to do it that way. No. In our cases here, if DuPont, for instance, had leased out the premises on one of these installations and given the rights to run it and control it to someone else, then DuPont wouldn't have a duty to anybody. And that's what I was trying to say. Clearly, Your Honor, in all the cases, there is no Delaware case that supports the defendant's position that matter and method control over the contractors is necessary in a 343 situation.
Mr. Lilly, let me ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Manwaring. Mr. Manwaring said that there were at least two cases where the asbestos was actually brought onto the premises by a contractor as distinguished from the landowner. Does that describe all of the cases before us, or are there cases where the asbestos was there and the contractors were hired to remove it?
Let me try to break it down, Your Honor. First of all, none of the plaintiffs in this case, in my opinion, were used asbestos. There were the two pipe fitters that used gaskets, but I'm not convinced that even we've ever pursued a gasket case in Delaware, and I'm not sure there's any dust from it. If they carry gaskets in there, then they carry asbestos-containing products there, but that's not the exposures that we're contesting, Your Honor.
My question goes to whether the asbestos was already on the property when the contractors came to do their work, or whether the asbestos was brought onto the property by the contractor.
It was there on the property, Your Honor.
In all
it was
cases.
Also brought on the property.
All right.
And, you know, because the pipes, when they are insulated, if it's a repair job, the pipes are insulated when the contractors arrive. That insulation has to be knocked off the pipes, causing all this dust, has to be swept off, and then new insulation applied after the pipes are changed. So, yes, it's both. When we're talking about, I'm asking you to reverse common law for 30 years. If the defendants bring up the Cini versus Dover County, the Dover County Club Apartments. And that's a trench accident. And it involved 414 in the lease statement. That's a Chapter 15. Let me explain to you that Chapter 15 are the exceptions to the general rule that an independent contractor, that a premises owner is not responsible for the tortious conduct of the independent contractor if he leaves it alone, allows the independent contractor to do the work in his own way, he doesn't put any requirements on the contractor, he steps away and the contractor causes injury, the premises owner is not responsible. The statement says that the exceptions to that general rule are more numerous than the application of the general rule, and they're all contained in Chapter 15. And it's obvious that in Chapter, we're talking about Chapter 15 cases, that control is the main issue in the case. Cindy was a 414 case, Chapter 15, and it involved a trench accident. In that case, the contractor was in charge of digging the trench and bringing in the pipes, and there was no responsibility of the owner for anything. There was no control over it, so the court specifically rejected a claim under 414 under Chapter 15. But, significantly, that didn't end the court's job, because there was also a safe workplace doctrine claim under 3403. And the court, even after deciding there was no control, had more work to do, because that didn't resolve the 343 case. This is a Delaware case. And the court held there that liability is not imposed where the owner and the contractor are equally knowledgeable. And that's exactly what we've been talking about. You've got to have an owner who knows and an invitee who doesn't. In seeing this case that the defendants say, I am about to destroy Delaware common law forever, is exactly what I've been saying it is. 343 is what it says, and if the only way the defendants can make this article or this argument is to constantly wrap Chapter 15 cases involving control with the 343 cases, see, you need control. Another case that they argue is O'Connor versus Diamond State. It was an accident involving a fall from a telephone pole by a worker for an independent contractor. He fell because the pole was covered with poison ivy vines. He fell because the sharp part of the climber went into the vine and knocked the pole, and he fell. He filed suit under two different claims. One, number one, Chapter 15 again, control, and number two, 343. And again, in O'Connor, the Delaware court decided the 414 claim based upon control. But their job wasn't done because control could not take care of the 343 case, because 343 only involves a situation where the premises owner knows of a latent defect and doesn't warn the invitee. And again, Connor, it decided that case based upon the fact that anybody walking up to the pole would have seen the vines. It was obvious, it wasn't latent, and it's not 343. So that court made two separate decisions, 414 and then 313.
What's your response to the question that I asked opposing counsel, who said that asbestos on its own is not a latent defect, it's not a hazardous material, there's, you know, it's nothing until it's misused?
Well, the theory of this case, and there was no abuse of the asbestos products only evidence in this case is these contractors did a great job. Some of them poisoned the others, though. But workmanship was good, because you could not use the asbestos among other people safely.
Well, I'm not following your response. Under 343, in order for there to be liability, there has to be a latent defect on the property, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're claiming that the asbestos is the latent defect that's on the property, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and opposing counsel says, well, that's wrong, because asbestos on its own is not hazardous, defective, latent, or anything else. It's just some material that becomes dangerous, if it does, only when it's misused.
Well, DuPont and the defendants enter into contracts with the the contractors to have the asbestos disturbed, to have new asbestos applied, knowing that asbestos would be in the air, both from the existing asbestos available going to be disturbed, and from the new asbestos being brought in to be installed. And I, you know, Your Honor, I think that when they, and the evidence in this case is that DuPont knew that the dust was going to be in the air when they signed the contracts. The mere fact that asbestos is left alone cannot be a reason to find the defendants not responsible when they, in fact, requested that the asbestos be disturbed in place and also be used in the new asbestos among the other workers. So I submit to you that since the disease is benign, since it takes 20, 30, or 40 years for the first symptoms of the disease to come forth, that it is a latent defect, and one that DuPont simply cannot ignore.
So in a latent defect is really the dust in the air. With 2020 hindsight, DuPont should have said to these innocent contractors, you're entering our premises where we have asbestos dust in the air.
Yeah, I don't want to go outside of my area of expertise, you know, but they could have done a lot of things. They could have said, hey, look, work here at your peril, but I'm telling you, it's dangerous here. They could have said, wear respirators. They could have said a lot of things, but they didn't.
The problem that we're trying to grapple with is to understand your side's position as to what exactly the latent defect is. Is it simply the asbestos sitting there on site, or is it asbestos dust that's created from human contact, from working with the material, or is it any contact at all by a human being touching that material, or is it something else? What is it?
I would say, Your Honor, that what we are saying is the dust in the air during the operation when all of these independent contractors were there, and while the DuPont safety people were walking around seeing the conditions there, that was the latent condition.
Dust in the air.
Yes, Your Honor.
Still, at the risk of being insensitively practical, why should we be concerned beyond the fact that DuPont paid for workers' compensation coverage for the workers of the independent contractors other than those working directly with the asbestos? Let's assume for a moment that we're going to be capable of distinguishing the cases that apply to the employees of an independent contractor and cases that might apply to guests on the premises that are doing no work at all.
Yes, sir.
Licensees of any kind, and now employees of independent contractors that were not working with asbestos and were not informed that there was asbestos on the premises. Why doesn't it end with the acknowledgement that they have workers' comp? Why should they have the right to sue anyone else?
And they meaning, Your Honor, that
the employees of the independent contractors
who were
neither warned nor are working with asbestos.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, it's really not a remedy that can even compare with the common law right to maintain suit against the premises owner.
Well, it's true of the employees of every employer, isn't it? That workers' comp has its compensations, at the risk of sounding trite. And society avoids the cost of third-party lawsuits. There's something for everybody in workers' comp. Why doesn't that end the lesson right here?
Could I take us to California, perhaps, Your Honor, to talk about the...
Well, is there a more practical state than California you can take us to?
No, but I think they're completely impractical, Your Honor. But I believe that once we go through the situation there, as far as their concerns about workman's compensation, basically what California did was, to begin with, was in a peculiar risk case. Peculiar risk is a Chapter 15 claim in which it says that when a premises owner wants to have dangerous work done upon his premises, he can hire an independent contractor, but if it involves a peculiar risk, such as demolishing a building or something that's very dangerous, he cannot escape liability by hiring an independent contractor. If someone, a third person, is injured by a peculiar risk, the theory being that it is public policy that an innocent third party hurt by a peculiar risk situation should have more than one pocket to go after in case the negligent independent contractor goes bankrupt or whatever else. So in a peculiar risk situation, the landowner is sitting there not wrong, not negligent, but there for public policy reasons. And the California situation started when the California court said, wait a minute, in this case, when we have an employee of the negligent independent contractor who's injured, and his only rights against his employer is workman's compensation, but his rights against the completely innocent home office of premises owner is a full-blown common law trial, that's unfair. So when it is the employee of a independent contractor who is negligent, who is injured, in California under this line of cases, they started saying, no, it's unfair to be able to go full bore against the premises owner, but only workman's compensation against this negligent independent contractor. But I'm suggesting, Your Honor, in this case, we have just the opposite situation, because we have completely innocent independent contractors. They didn't even know that asbestos caused disease. They were painters. So what Your Honor is suggesting is that we punish the innocent independent contractor by saying your workman's compensation only, file a claim against your employer.
Well, in the superficial sense, but if you look at workers' comp in the broader sense, first, by contract, DuPont's paying the bill for the workers' comp on this particular project. Number two, workers' comp also has the allegedly social desirability of spreading the risk across all employers. So the cost of that employer is minimized by the fact that the risks are spread throughout all workers' comp providers in the state or perhaps even in the region. So that's the diversity and benefit of spreading risk by privately paid insurance.
You are saying, Your Honor, that in fact this would apply only to asbestos? Or does it apply to just independent contractors? You know, I'm
simply asking you. You heard the argument from Mr.
Well,
Van Lering.
I disagree that you can't get punitive damages under workman's compensation. A poor widow cannot get loss. A wife cannot get loss of consortium. We have the legislative intent in passing the workman's compensation statute, where the legislature made it clear that even though you're collecting, you're not choosing a remedy when you file your claim for workers' compensation, you can sue whoever you found who actually hurt you.
No, I understand that. The issue before us is, does it, in part, make sense to interpret 343 in a situation where a landowner is paying for workers' comp to cover an employee of an independent contractor who's injured on the premises? That's what Mr. Mannering suggested. I'm simply asking you to respond to it.
I think it ignores the fact, first of all, Your Honor, of the statutory scheme in Delaware. But secondly, Your Honor, it ignores the fact that you're putting the burden of increased workman's compensation rates on an independent contractor with nothing to do with the injury. You know, and besides that, it would be a boon to, if you're saying only workman's compensation, it certainly would be a boon to anybody who supplied, who required, who ordered the asbestos. They would all escape scot-free just because the victim in this case happens to be employed by an independent contractor. I think that would be grossly unfair. If the guy was a coat delivery man who was filling the machine and got a dose of asbestos and later filed, so he'd be okay. But only because of an accident of employment would you limit him to workman's compensation. And the insanity in California probably exceeded what you just said, but in the years that followed Privet, now the California court is saying workman's compensation only, just like you, it applies to 343. That case, Kinsman, has been up on appeal for 4 years now. I don't think it's back yet. It's causing them a lot of trouble because it's problematic. Any questions?
Well, help us recall what was going on in Rocco versus DuPont. We're talking about a different section of the restatement, but Judge Babiaras was also the judge in Rocco.
Right.
And we seem to be working our way through the restatement. What are the other differences between this case and Rocco?
In Rocco, we were under Chapter 15, which I've talked about more than I've talked about 343 up here. Chapter 15 is exceptions to that general rule. 343 is simple. 343 says if there's a latent defect and you have invitees on your property and they don't know about it, you're to warn them. And that's what this case is all about, and that's what it was.
So we're basically talking about similarly situated people who lost under Section 15 in Broca, and now they'd like to prevail under Section 343. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, but I think that the Section 15 was problematic, not like 343, because of other courts outside of this state who interpreted 15. But I believe, Your Honor, that we should have been under 343 in Rome.
Thank you, Mr. Lowe.
Your Honor, let me quickly address the workman's compensation issue. Mr. Lilly suggests you, but for the accident of employment, why should workers' comp apply? And the answer is simple. First of all, his people are mere licensees on the premises. They don't enjoy a status beyond that. Secondly, the contract price included payment for their comp coverage. Third, the Roca case says that the policy consideration is just that. That is that the comp covers it. And to institute a situation of vicarious liability is not necessary since comp does, in fact, cover it. Beyond that, Your Honor, this is not merely an accident of employment. The difference between the delivery person coming on the premises and Mr. Lilly's clients is that the delivery person's comp isn't paid for by DuPont or these landowners. So So the landowners here have paid for the comp. Now, with regard to this chapter 15, verse 343, Mr. Lilly concedes or agrees that the general rule is that the landowner is not liable for the negligence of an independent contractor. He also agrees that the peculiar risk exceptions under chapter 15 do not apply to these plaintiffs since these landowners do not exercise control. That's the ruling of ROCA. What he's done is he's tried to recast the exact same facts in ROCA that were Chapter 15, you know, or peculiar risk facts, as 343 facts. And now insists that he can succeed under 343. However, both the Watcher case, that's his own case, and the Kinsman case, say that 343 has to be harmonized with the Chapter 15 exceptions to the general rule. And both those cases come to the conclusion that Section 343 requires control. And this is entirely logical. It makes no sense to think that recovery for the identical conduct would be prohibited under Chapter 15 exceptions, yet allowed under Section 343. So that all the plaintiff has to do is, you know, call it something different? That can't possibly be what the Restatement of Torts had in mind. The Privet line of cases in California has consistently relied upon the theory that 343 and Chapter 15 need to be interpreted similarly.
Well, as I understand Mr. Lilly's argument, if we go back to ROCA, he recalled on appeal in ROCA, Section 343 wasn't fairly raised in the brief, and Judge Babiarz, as an opinion, said this is not a 343 case. Judge Babiarz ruled you lose under Section 15.
Correct.
Now, in this case, Judge Babiarz said, all right, 343 is before me, and you win.
Yes, but he overlooked the Furyk holding that requires control. And clearly, Mr. Lilly and I are going to forever disagree on Furyk, but I clearly, as I said to you earlier, the Furyk court ran through the indicia of control. It started about the student guideline policies, the fraternity hazing policy, the various letters, a meeting that was held, and noted that the university's regulation of fraternities was pervasive and significant. The Furyk court specifically said the duty of the university to regulate and supervise should be limited to those instances where it exercises control. It then said there was a jury question of whether or not what it had done was sufficient to be considered control. But 343, Your Honors, in the factual context of this case, has been decided and specifically ruled upon by three different courts. All three of those courts have adopted the defendant's position. All three of those courts have rejected Mr. Lilly's position. One of those courts was actually Mr. Lilly's case, where he tried to do the same thing there that he's doing here. He'd lost on Chapter 15, so he recast his Chapter 15 claims as a 343 claim, and the Watcher Court just flat out rejected it. The Kinsman Court has made the same holding. We suggest that those courts should be followed. To listen to Mr. Lilly, he would have you believe that there's no control under Furyk. That's simply wrong. You cannot create a situation where you have control under Section 344, yet no control under Section 343 in Delaware. That would make no sense. All that would do would be make a different standard for commercial landowners as opposed to residential landowners. That's not what this court ought to do. According to Mr. Lilly, the duty to act is triggered simply because you're the landowner. That means that the University of Delaware's duty is triggered because it's the landowner. DuPont's duty is triggered here because it's the landowner. That's not the law. And to turn that into the law would wreak economic havoc on landowners and businesses. Under that theory, a landowner would never be able to acquit or discharge its responsibilities by hiring a competent, skilled, knowledgeable, independent contractor.
Even the Chief Justice read from the opinion where apparently DuPont conceded knowledge, and I responded. Is that correct, that DuPont, for purposes of summary judgment, concedes knowledge and wants this case to turn on absence of control?
That's correct, Your Honor. But we did not concede knowledge to the extent that Mr. Lilly wants to try to tell you we now have knowledge. That was not the argument made in the lower court. That's not what they've got in their briefs. I mean, Mr. Lilly's description here today is beyond all ken. I mean, it is rhetoric. But we want this decision to turn on control. We think it's controlled by Furyk, and
it depends on what the word concedes mean.
I'm sorry.
You lost me.
I didn't mean to do that, certainly. But
you conceded it, but not to the extent that Mr. Lilly has said you conceded it. I don't get that.
Well, let me put it this way.
Depends on what the meaning of is, or something like that.
Your Honor, I don't get in that discussion. We concede that we want this case to turn on control as opposed to knowledge. We concede that there's enough.
There's enough evidence, knowledge, to go to the jury.
Yes.
But without control, it doesn't go to the jury. It's that simple, right?
Yes. Okay. In the absence of control, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Is our position.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned.